This is Kate Moorhead Carroll in the podcast Find It. Today I have a wonderful conversation I want to share with you with the artist and leader of the Yellow House, Hope McMath. Hope, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for coming today.
I'm glad to be here.
It's exciting
to be here with you. Thank you.
Yeah. You're first and foremost, I think of you as an artist. Is that right? Is that appropriate?
It is.
Okay.
I don't think most people do think that, but I love that you do, because I do. I do. I've never known life without thinking of being an artist.
And tell us about that. When is your earliest memory of being drawn to art, and why? Why are you drawn to art? Why do you do art?
I mean, I don't really remember my first interaction with art. I remember always making it. Which also means it was always accessible to me. You know, in school, art was something that was being done every day. At my home, it may have just been as simple as a roll of paper and crayons or paint, but it was always there, and so I was always making. And it's something that I've carried through my whole life. I went to college for it, and I've taught it, and I sort of feel like I've been on all sides of the art piece.
So you'd be feeling something and that would come, you would express yourself in the art? Your parents must have had access to providing you with stuff or encouraging you.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it was less about expressing. I don't know what drove me as a kid to make art, except that it was just, for me, it was like walking and breathing.
Wow.
I felt the same way about reading, right? It was like walking, breathing, reading, making art, and stopping for a meal, right? And I sort of feel like my life is still kind of like that. I feel like I've been sort of consistent with that. I mean, you know, by the time I was a teenager, I was making art because I felt like it was my best way to express who I was, the way I was processing the world around me. You know, the signs then were small, but they got larger. And I realize I now make art because I don't know how not to make art. I mean, it really, for me, is something very essential. It's part of what sustains me in a very real way. I went through a period for about 6 years where I wasn't making art. And I realized I was a very different person then.
Interesting.
So I now know not to go there. Mm. I'm not good in the world if I'm not if I'm not making things. So.
It keeps you well.
It keeps me well, for sure.
Did you go to school? Where did you go to school? Did you get trained in art in school in any way?
Yeah. So I'm a product of the public schools. Art was just sort of an informal part of what I did at school. I actually went to Jacksonville University. I had a free ride to go to Savannah for school, but needed to stay home for family reasons. And so Dr. Fran Kinney, who was the president at JU at the time, when I called her up sort of meekly and said, you know, I know y'all offered me a scholarship and I turned it down, but can I now get it? Because I need it. Mm-hmm. And she didn't hesitate. And so I studied art history and visual art there as an undergraduate, and then worked in the graphic design field for a bit of time, realized that wasn't my calling. Mm-hmm. So I went back and got a master's in arts education, and I found my love of printmaking during my master's program. So yes, so I did go to school for art, but I did that here in my hometown.
Okay, and you just tried different kinds of art until you found the right fit for you.
Yes, yes.
And then postgraduate school, when I got here, I think you were head of the Cummer, or you had been for a while. Tell us from there to the Cummer, where did you go and what happened?
So I actually started graduate school and working at the Cummer in the same week.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I was part-time. I started at the Cummer as a part-time educator. I was there on Monday and Wednesday mornings leading tours for school children.
Oh, wow.
So education was very much at the heart of what I was doing, still in some ways is very much at the heart of what I do. And I started my master's program at the same time. So for about a year, I was part-time at the Cummer doing graduate studies, and then I became director of education after the amazing mentoring of Jean Hall Dodge, who I know so many of you know Jean. I can't even start to talk about her because it just makes me weep, the impact that she had on my life. And
Jean is an Episcopal deacon, for those of you who don't know her, and used to be here but has retired now.
Yes. Yeah, so, but I was director of education for about 10 years and then became a very reluctant director of the museum.
Well, can I stop you for a minute?
Yes.
I want to know, when you're giving children a tour of an art museum, what's that like? That must have been wonderful. Children are so open to art and to the spiritual. Give us a couple of examples of joyful moments or just something that happened.
I mean,
it is
really life-giving to sit a group of even very young children down in front of a work of art and simply pose a question, put a question into the space. That helps them sort of look deeply and take in the work of art and then process it through their little young minds and then spit something back out. And I mean, it was daily. You know, people's young children's response to beauty, their curiosity about what they were seeing and the questions they would ask back, their connection to just creativity and storytelling is so innate and raw at that time. You know, I have a couple quick incidences. You know, one, I had been taking a group of, it was a group of almost all boys, and they were like third or fourth grade, if I remember right. And we went out, we had been on a tour, and we were doing a tour about landscapes. And they were sort of really into the paintings. They loved them. They were, you know, sort of relating it to, you know, things they'd been studying in school. And then we walked out into the gardens. This little boy, his name was Ezekiel, actually. I remember it well.
Like the prophet.
And he walked out in the gardens, and he stopped. He stopped the whole line. He was the line leader, and he wouldn't move. And he was so overtaken by the beauty of the place. And he exclaimed really loudly to me, he asked the question of whether we had just stepped into the Garden of Eden.
Aww.
So obviously he was having these conversations around sort of beauty and special places, you know, in whatever community he was in, or whether it's at his kitchen table, right? But he was relating it to where we were. But I also had experiences where young people would see a more modern work of art that was dealing with there's an amazing painting at the Cummer called Parade to War. And the conversations I had with fourth and fifth graders in front of a painting about people marching off to war were some of the most profound conversations I've ever had about art.
Wow.
Them wanting to know, like, why do we march off to war, right? Why does the woman in the corner of the painting who looks older than everybody, why is she weeping?
Right?
Like, those kinds of conversations where you're really talking about a work of art, but you're actually talking about something much larger.
Yeah, it's as if they're shining light onto the art and bringing the art out.
Very much so.
Because they're so innocent and pure.
Yeah, very much so.
Amazing. Wow. So then you become the executive director, which is a different role, obviously. Lots of fundraising, lots of administration, which you obviously did really well.
I loved it, most of it. You know, it was a lot of fundraising. It was a lot of administration and working with an amazing team of people. It was also during a time where museums were undergoing some pretty radical shifts in this country and across the world, as museums were asking themselves, what is the role that we play in society beyond preserving art objects? Mm. Right? When we say we are a place of education, is that education for all people, or is it education for the few? Mm. And so it was a dynamic time to be in that world. And because I was an educator, because I was sort of awakening to issues of like social justice and civic engagement, it was a really exciting time to think about and work with really great people on how do we sort of push a museum from being a place that felt separate from society and it being a place that would actually be not only accessible to all people, but shaped by all people. And so yeah, it was a really dynamic time, a hard time, but a dynamic time.
And it seems like you've moved in that direction, and it certainly impacted your life.
Very much so.
So tell us about this inward journey you've done, because this art is about justice, it's about truth telling, it's about racial reconciliation. Tell us about so you're the director of the Kummer, and it sounds like it led you to look at your own history in that time.
It did. I mean, I wasn't doing as much of that at that time, but I was looking at myself and the role I wanted to play in this world. I was deeply affected by things like Trayvon Martin's murder. I was very impacted by watching my own city grappling with the first round of a human rights ordinance, right? Those things were very top of the heap at the time that I was director at the Kummer. The murders at the AME church in Charleston, those things had a deep impact on me. And as I was trying to think about what is the role of art in all of this, right? If art is the thing I know and have, what does that mean when these things are happening around me, where these tensions are becoming so evident? And it was really when I was waking up every day thinking about those things that I realized the Kummer may not be the right place for me.
Right.
And so the sort of leap out of that gave me some space to start this deeper internal journey that led to what my art said and looked like, my looking into my own past, my creation of a place like Yellow House, which I actually consider part of my practice as an artist and an educator and a healer and an organizer. And so it took me a year of both sort of licking my wounds and thinking deeply about what would be the next phase of my life, and was art going to be a part of it? And what I recognized was that it was going to be all about that.
Wow. I want to pause for a minute just to say, what a great example of discernment. Isn't that amazing? So she was able to step away from her work and really pray deeply. I don't know if you'd call it prayer, but you reflected and you thought and you were led into more fullness of who you really are and how you need to express yourself. But it took a little time away from the busyness, didn't it?
It took
we're
time
trying
away
to learn
from
about
the
sermon all the time.
Yeah,
so.
the it took time away from the busyness, and it took time away from the noise.
Yeah.
You know, my departure from the Kummer was personally disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of other people and groups, it was disruptive. And it took time to sort of move through that, not around it.
Disappointed people.
Yeah.
And
it was shattering for me. I mean, I was at the Kummer for 23 years and thought I would be there in some ways much longer. And so, but, you know, one of my favorite writers and thinkers, James Baldwin, talks about the idea that, you know, for real deep change to happen, sometimes it requires for everything we know to get shattered.
Wow.
And that was like a foundational idea for me. Instead of seeing it as something really awful, it was like, well, what is on the other side of this shattering?
Right. Why is everything falling apart right now? What's going to be born? What is this, a birth pang? Either you can see things as a falling apart, an end, or it's a beginning. A birthing of something new.
That's right. That's right.
So tell us about your inward journey. You looked at your own history. Tell us about your history.
So yeah, I started several years ago to get involved with a group called 90 Forward, which is an anti-racism group here in Jacksonville. And we began making pilgrimages to Montgomery, Alabama. So this work sort of started for me in 2018, let's say. On those pilgrimages, I was working as a facilitator often in holding space, in creating a circle as we were all going through these spaces that deal with the beauty and the difficulties of the South, the beauty and the difficulties of our histories, especially around race. And on one of the trips, we were coming home on the bus, which is about a 7.5-hour ride, so you have lots of time to think. And I realized I was doing a lot of holding space where other people were sharing their stories, and especially where my black peers and friends knew And were sharing stories of you know, their parents and their grandparents and sort of a connection to their ancestry, even if they didn't know always the specifics of it.
Right.
And I realized I, as much as I was sort of doing in community, I had not done my own work.
What a revelation.
I had become maybe somewhat of a voyeur, always peeking into other people's experiences, but often not offering up my own, how whatever that was going to look like. And I realized it was in part because I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized maybe I was avoiding it intentionally because I really didn't want to see it.
Right.
And it didn't take long for me, as I made that commitment on the ride home from Montgomery, to begin looking into my own family's history. And it wasn't that it was not easy to find. It was really easy to find. And it was dark, and it was heavy, and it was absolutely counter to the kind of life I was trying to live. And so I became really interested in what does it look like from a place of responsibility to know my family's history as enslavers, as people who pushed indigenous people off their lands, as members of the KKK throughout the South. What did it mean to be a white woman in a Southern community, my home community, doing this justice work, and realizing, one, I had gone 50 years without looking into this, and two, what do I do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
In the Christian language, we call that repentance, where you turn out of yourself and you kind of have to give up yourself. But ironically, you had to look at the dark side of yourself in order to do that.
Yeah.
That's an amazing journey and very hard. So tell us about this art. How did that journey inspire this art?
Well, I mean, it sort of goes back to where our conversation started. You know, as I did all the research, I became very focused on the intellectual side of this, right? Doing genealogy work and going and looking in archives in little small towns in Alabama and Georgia. And I was already very much a student of the South and a student of Reconstruction and segregation. And so I finally, after about a year of doing that, thought, hope you are avoiding pushing this stuff that you're doing intellectually. I was avoiding pushing it sort of into my heart and into my belly. And so I knew the way I knew how to do that is through the artistic process. So I went from it being a research project into being art making. And so it became something more emotional and much more personal.
Well, that is something that people say to me a lot. They say, why do we need to go back and browbeat ourselves over what has gone before? I don't want to look at that. I don't see how that's helpful. I think you all are just whipping yourselves all the time.
Yeah.
Tell us about why you don't agree with that perspective.
I don't agree with that perspective at all. I actually think there is something about us as human beings that keeps thinking if we ignore the past, we are somehow going to be better and grander and more loving than anybody who came before us, right? That we're going to just somehow magically figure all this out. One, I believe that there are models in our history of both what to do better and what not to do again.
Amen to that.
And I think until we look at those clearly.
Both of them, not just the good stuff.
Both of them, the bad stuff and the good stuff, right? There are great people and there were people who did bad things for all kinds of reasons. And I think we need to understand both of those. The other reason I think it's important is I think we have a very hard time being discerning often of the moment in which we're living, and we think it's so wildly unique. And the fact is it's not. And so I'm very interested in what does it mean to truly stare at the truth, the wretchedness of it, and the goodness in it, right? And to not overly judge it, but to be a student of it.
To forgive,
to see all of that in ourselves, mm-hmm. right? For me, looking into this past was a mirror that I really wanted to look in, no matter how complicated and messy it was. Mm-hmm. And I also think because history is messy, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable, and because it's uncomfortable, a lot of people want to move away from it. I actually think it is such a teacher for us to sit at the feet of.
Sure is. And individually, I mean, I know from a therapeutic perspective, if you want to be well in this life, you have to look at your own personal past. And if you did something bad or if someone hurt you, you really need to look at it in order to be well. You can't pretend it didn't happen, and it just doesn't work. It keeps coming up again. So to that extent, unless we look at the dark stuff and bring it into the light and say, oh, we're sorry, and we forgive ourselves and others and whatever, you never get past it. You never let it go. It kind of chases you around.
It does chase you. And I think the idea of, and you'll see these words throughout the artwork, words like reckon, words like remember, words like repair, right? Words like justice.
Truth.
We don't get to the unity people want to talk about without going through justice. Mm-hmm. And to understand what justice means, not just to me, but to my neighbors, I have to understand the harm that's been done. And in my case, I wanted to understand who in my ancestry did that harm. And this is the really hard part about it for me. I try very hard not to do it from a place of very strange, like, guilt or like wallowing in some sort of woe is me that I have this in my past. It's really not that at all. I'm trying to address it as it is. I look into the face of my ancestors like Hakalia McMath, who the poor guy has become the poster child for my whole family and all that they did wrong, right? Because I happen to have his photograph.
Mm-hmm.
So he carries this weight as a symbol, right? But I look at him and I understand the harm that happened in the generations before him, right? Led to the role he had to play. But I also understand all along that way, people were making decisions and choices to either be a part of that wrong or not.
Yeah.
And so then what does it mean to recognize that and say, I may be part of harmful systems, but what is my role in disrupting that?
Yeah.
In interrupting that?
So many people, Hope, are afraid to look at this stuff, and in fact are rebelling against it.
Yeah.
And we see that all the time in the national scene. Why so much fear? Why do you think there's so much fear at looking at the past and really reconciling to the past?
I mean, I think some of it is a miseducation, right, for all of us. You know, when you grow up learning the world is a certain way and you are brought to believe in certain truths like the lost cause narrative of, you know, the supremacy of white people and the supremacy of the South, like those are hard, like those are shattering things to recognize when you grow up with that may not be the full truth.
It's like realizing Santa Claus doesn't exist or
something. Right, I mean, you know, the way we weep when things that we hold so dear, we learn are like not real, it can be very shattering. And I think we don't want to go there, you know, it then causes us to question so much of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested in approaching that instead with a heart marked by curiosity, by a desire for the beloved community. the fear is real, and the fear is in part real because of the myths that we all have held for a long time. And I also think as human beings, we just often fear loss and discomfort
and change.
Separation and change. All those things are complicated and messy and awkward. And I don't mind being in the mess, which is also why my art looks like a mess. Like the process of making it, I wanted to also represent the process of going through it.
Mm. As a visual person and as a person of truth, let's talk, we just have a little bit more time, but let's talk about the media for a minute, because we talked about people not wanting their myths crashed, but we're seeing so much exploitation of fear in the media using imagery now, generated imagery, using art for disillusioning and art for creating panic and criticism and judgment. How can we learn the difference between an art that is truth-telling and an art that is propaganda?
Right, because art has always served a role in propaganda. You know, I teach AP art history, and we just finished talking about the rise and fall of ancient Rome. And, you know.
Well, did they use art? Yeah.
I mean, they used art as something that was both beautiful but also propagandist, you know. And so that is very much out there. And I think curiosity is the key, not to believe everything that we see, right?
Yes.
That even when something like art seduces us into connecting to a message, that we need to peel back the layers of that to understand its source.
Mm.
Symbols matter. If they didn't matter, people wouldn't always be holding them up high, mm-hmm. and other people working to tear them down. They
yes.
become a rallying point, but we need to understand them and not just accept them. For me, artistic symbols are kind of like sound bites in the media.
Mm.
They become easy to sort of be wooed by, seduced by, and it is up to each one of us to question it, to be curious enough to dig beneath the surface of it, to be in conversation about it,
mm.
To recognize that those images and messages are incredibly complicated, and many of them based on long histories.
Yes.
So if we don't understand that history, we're not going to understand what that image is trying to do today.
A lot of that is about education, and one of the goals I have for this congregation is to begin to help all of us interpret media and interpret art and be smarter to be able to triage and be wise and have a media diet.
That's right.
All of that stuff.
That's right. That's right.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for being here. Let's give her a round of applause. Thank you for joining me in this podcast. May God bless you and keep you always.